Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host, and my co-host from Imagine Publicity, president of Imagine Publicity, Delilah Jones, is with me as my co-host today. So good evening again, and we welcome you across the nation from wherever you are. And I'd like to say we have a wonderful, renowned guest, someone who is known internationally to speak on some very important topics, and we're very, very pleased to have her. And before we bring her in, I just want to make a couple of announcements. Why don't we bring Delilah in? Good evening, Delilah. How are you?
Hi, Donna. Happy to be here, as always. Looking forward, very much forward to this show. I'm so interested to hear what Dr. Danielli has to impart for our listeners tonight.
Yes, I agree, because although we've had Dwayne Bowers, who's also a very skilled trauma specialist, I think Dr. Danielli's areas of expertise are so broad and expansive. We could probably do an eight-hour show, you know, but in any case, before we get to the topic at hand, just want to make a couple very brief announcements, and then I will give some highlights to her background and welcome her on. Announcement number one, we still have the promotion going on. Myself and Jeff Mudgett, author of Bloodstains, you know, he's a direct descendant of H.H. Holmes, a.k.a. Herman Mudgett, a.k.a. Jack the Ripper. And wouldn't that be a good conversation if Dr. Danielli and Jeff Mudgett were to talk? I wonder, maybe we should introduce them. But we were offering an autographed copy of his book, if you'll kindly go on our website and look and just read our blog and listen to the show. It's a fascinating book, and it's true, it's not folklore. We're offering that till the end of July. And just a second announcement I'd like to make quickly. Please, if you like this show, if you like DonnaGore.com in terms of my website and what I have in terms of writing and my thoughts, would you kindly go into LinkedIn and give me a recommendation, whether it's a checkbox or a written recommendation is even better, because I'm trying to make a lot of friends over there, and that also does help me with my future goals. I would so appreciate it, okay? So with that taken care of, Dr. Dale Danielli is a clinical psychologist in private practice in New York City, specializing in victimology, mass trauma, survivors, and children of survivors. She's received the Lifetime Achievement Awards, and many of them, and most recently from the American Psychological Association in Trauma Psychology. She conceived and assisted in creating the first PhD program in international psychology. And she's an expert in all matters concerning the Holocaust, and has served as a consultant on crime prevention and with the World Health Organization. She's also served as director of psychological services for the Center for Rehabilitation of Torture Victims, and was also a sergeant in the Israeli Defense Forces. And on, she's written numerous books and publications. But I have the feeling with all of her accomplishments, she's still a very down-to-earth, approachable person. So with that, I'll just say, Gail, thank you so much for giving us your valuable time and agreeing to be on Shattered Lives. Welcome. It's a pleasure to have you.
You're most welcome, my dear. Thank you.
Well, very good. We have many things that we could talk about because of your broad area of expertise. But in our previous emails back and forth and conversations, I think we would like to focus on mass trauma and secondary victimization, and that can take many forms. But maybe for us to, in terms of getting started, I know you spoke of in your emails a conspiracy of silence about victimization and trauma. And maybe if we define that term, that would be a good way to start. What do you mean by that with regard to victimization? What is a conspiracy of silence?
What I mean by it is to point out to a process that happens consciously or unconsciously and not necessarily intentionally, whereby listening to atrocities is painful and too much for people, or that's how they experience it. And as a result, they use various ways of basically not letting the victim speak, to shut them up, to repress them, to put them aside, to tell them that, for example, you know, the life is in the here and now, let bygones be bygones, even blaming victims. They use all kinds of techniques. And I said I don't even mean it intentionally, to not be overwhelmed by what they hear or might hear from the victim. And the victim senses it, and at some point the victim, out of despair and out of many other reasons, if you want, we'll talk about it, gets the message to shut up and not to speak about their victimization.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking, they're not necessarily overt, but they're subtle types of ways?
Some are overt, and some are very subtle, yes.
Mm-hmm.
For example, a woman has been raped, and the first question is, what did you wear? How did you walk? The first question to a theft victim is, did you leave your door open? That's immediately blaming the victim without thinking twice about it, in order not to feel overwhelmed by the reality of the powerlessness and the helplessness of victimization. And when we even call it blaming the victim, this is nothing new. And there's so many examples. Another way is simply to change the subject.
I'm sorry, can you say that one again?
To change the topic.
Oh, it's like changing the topic?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Another way that's more subtle is to say, I know exactly what you mean. After which, there's no more reason to say anything. It's a very
okay
way of shutting somebody up.
Dr. Daniele, do you feel that this is, I don't think this is just mass trauma. I think a lot of times people have a problem with dealing with someone else's victimization, whether it's out of denial or whether it's out of ignorance, they don't know how to deal with the emotions and the feelings that person might be having, especially if they personally were not a part of that. Do you agree, or is there more to that?
Oh, absolutely. I did not mean to limit my comments to only massively traumatized individuals. I understand mm-hmm. that the audience comes from all kinds of experiences. So I'm trying, and I'm trying to be cognizant of that. You're absolutely correct, and the examples I brought make the point that you just made.
Mm-hmm.
So we agree. Let me add here.
Sure.
An old colleague, Martin Simmons, who used to be a New York City cop and then became a psychiatrist, coined this term, the second wound. The first wound wound being the actual victimization, and the second wound being what the victims experiences when people who are supposed to care for them, family members, neighbors, but even professional agents of society, such as law enforcement, media, doctors themselves, nurses, etc., etc., even psychotherapists themselves are not there to listen. And he says this is the second wound. I actually added the third wound,
which is the third wound.
Let me just complete that. What the victim does with the second wound, that is, rather than say, which the victim is not able to do at the time for understandable reasons, rather than say, they don't understand, I shouldn't pay attention to it, the victim accepts those implied judgments in that wound, and the victim harms himself or herself that way. So while the victim has no control over the first victimization, that is the victimization itself, or the second wound, that is how others respond to his or her victimization, the victim does have control over what he or she does with that.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore don't have to participate in the rewounding or second wounding process.
What's the third wound that you made reference to?
This is what I just described. The third wound is what you do with it internally.
Oh, okay. What you do with it internally is it's the third wound. I understand. I'm sorry.
Even externally deciding not to talk to anybody anymore about this.
Uh-huh. You kind of shut down then.
Exactly.
Is this pervasive, these wounds and the way this dynamic goes in terms of the victimization, is it pervasive for all eras and types of victimization, whether we're talking about, you know, what happened, you know, during the Holocaust or all the way up to present times with, say, what happened in Boston or Sandy Hook or something? Does it vary at all or with respect to the time frame or the type of victimization, or is it pretty
Of course, it varies like any other human behavior. But the tendency to not listen is common.
Mm-hmm.
And even when there is a sensational, quote-unquote, crime, which means the media amplifies the crime in sensationalizing ways, there might be attention for a short period of time, but as for the nature of, quotes, what we call news, that goes away, and the victim then again remains all by themselves. And we can talk about all of that also. That is what happens to, quote, public crimes. I remember victims of 9/11 saying that they couldn't not think about 9/11, because even when they left the house to go shopping, they would hear a radio program. There was no way for them to not have a private time, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Private is very
and that has its own consequences as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, so we're talking about a very complex process.
It certainly sounds that way. As victims, do we always notice the second victimization or the third, or is that something conscious that we are aware of, or
necessarily it could be conscious or not?
Okay.
Not necessarily, which is part of what makes it more difficult to get it. and to understand what's going on.
What types of reactions, I'm sure you've seen the gamut in terms of your research and working with people in private practice with respect to, say, if we go back to the mass trauma topic, what seems to be common in terms of people sharing that experience with regard to their reactions or how they tend to heal from something like that over, you know, a period of time. Can you talk about that a bit?
I'm not sure I got your question, but, let me say that healing is an ideal concept here. In many ways, we speak about learning to live with it without letting the memories and the affect
or like
victimization destroy you, continue to destroy you. It's most of the time it's long term. When the victims themselves are not helped in particular, very often there will be an impact on the second and even third and other generations to come. Healing is, as I said, is an ideal, so to speak, and it's a long-term process. We are not talking about 1, 2, 3 jump.
Imagine also other people would heal in different time frames. Wouldn't you agree that not everyone is going to be in the same path of healing and getting to the from point A to point B at the same time?
Right. And not even necessarily from point A to point B. Could be
right.
A to point E and then to C and then back to A and then to D.
It's kind of like the grieving process, too. It's not, you know, Kubler-Ross's stages are not, you know, A, B, C, D. It's 2 steps forward, 3 steps back kind of thing, right? And doesn't it have to do with how resilient you are as well, you know?
With how what it's you are?
How resilient you are.
Oh, absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up. Yes, we have learned that people are resilient.
But not everyone.
there are various degrees of resilience. For us to remain...
So how does that figure into the equation, whether I'm very resilient or just passively resilient? Or does resiliency grow within us when we've had a trauma happen, or is that something that's kind of inbred or genetic or what?
Again, I'm afraid I will sound silly again, but like everything else, it's a complex process. Resilience is not a static state, and it also has to do with the internal environment as well as with your relationship with the external environment and who is there. So we know, for example, to go back to the conspiracy of silence concept or the second wound, that when people are there for victims, when there is social support, it helps. And it helps, therefore, it can be a resilient factor in the general picture of the events and the outcome. To answer your questions, yes, some of it is genetic, but we are in the middle of studying exactly what resilience is and what it leads to. We talk about resilience in terms of not letting things affect one, or resilience as to coping with them, sort of getting shattered, to use your words, but bounce back. And, of course, future events will challenge whatever coping we have developed. There is Some of us are in disagreement about whether resilience is because of the trauma or despite of the trauma.
Mm-hmm.
There's a real difference, conceptually.
What's your opinion about that? How do you feel about that?
I feel that it's despite the trauma.
It's despite the trauma.
Yes.
Very interesting.
I think that after trauma we do develop realizations about what's important to us. We do have insights as to what we really value. We might even change our values because of it. And some of my colleagues call it post-traumatic growth, which is very much worth attending to and listening from. Attending to and learning from. And I believe, yes, all of this does exist. How long it stays, we are not totally sure. Again, much of this is new and we will keep learning. Some of my colleagues totally believe in it. And we should learn from them what leads them to totally believe in it. But all these concepts do exist, which means they reflect some phenomena that are there for us to learn from.
Yeah. Wow. What is there anything in particular with regard to what we've been discussing within the last few minutes? What does your most recent research reveal about, you know, dealing with mass trauma, for example? Are you working on something in particular, something new that everyone seems to agree on with respect to the new research?
You can't find anything everybody agrees on. Period. That's okay.
Right. Everyone has a different idea,
but,
I guess.
Now, my most recent research—we are sort of jumping ahead. My most recent research is. Well, let me rewind here.
Okay.
One of the realizations I had in my work with Holocaust survivors and their children is the heterogeneity among them. Just again to rewind, and I don't think you mentioned it, we built the first program to help Nazi Holocaust survivors and their children. And we built it, and this is not to give us accolades. It's actually to sadly say that up until the 70s, there was no systematic attention paid to their plight.
Wow.
Yes,
that's,
some writings about it, but by great people. But in terms of programs, there was very little. Part of the reasons we built that was because of the conspiracy of silence. I was doing my dissertation, and that connects you to the resilience too. I was doing my doctoral dissertation on the psychology of hope. In doing that, it was a rather complex study. In doing that, I focused on Nazi Holocaust survivors, terminally ill diagnosed people, and prisoners of war, POWs, whose hope was the most challenged. I took the courts, the hard cases where, scientifically that is, whereas my students and some colleagues did the quotes easier ones. The easier ones in the sense of what seems to be less challenge to hope, like missing a bus, like missing a bus. But what I found then in interviewing Holocaust survivors is across the board, they all said that nobody listened to them or believed them. And they shared the pain and the resulting suffering with me. Their children will describe something quite similar. And that is what led myself and some other colleagues build a group project for Holocaust survivors and their children, on the one hand, and on the other hand, led me to study the conspiracy of silence and the effects of the Holocaust and the conspiracy of silence, that is, on them, on the survivors, on their children, etc. Now, it's important here because the notion of the conspiracy of silence and Martin Simmons' notion of the second wound, both are saying what happens after this trauma is as serious as the trauma itself. As serious in the sense of it will predict the long-term effects of the trauma. It could either ameliorate if the survivors are given the right kind of help, which is so rare, even in developed countries. And if they are not given the kind of help they need, including justice, including many involved processes that could be contributing to healing, the effect will go to succeeding generations. So here I was, and at the time that we began our project, the main concept in the field, the main diagnosis, was what was called the survivor's syndrome. This is one of the precursors of what we today call PTSD, right, or post-traumatic stress disorder. So all psychiatrists, psychologists, etc., or many, diagnosed syndrome, and they even started writing about child of survivor syndrome. And what we saw in the project, what I saw, was not one syndrome. It wasn't just a bunch of symptoms. What it was are heterogeneous ways that survivors adapted in order to be able to live, to continue to live and survive life after the Holocaust.
Can you give us an illustration of that? Can you give us an illustration of that? What types of things
did
you do in order to live?
You got me into lecturing. What can I do?
I'm sorry if I distracted you.
No. I hope you don't succeed. What I name these are post-trauma adaptational styles. Adaptational in order to say this is what we do to adapt to life after. Styles also to say that these could be lifelong, even multi-generational. They're not just a bunch of symptoms that come and go and come, etc. These are ways of life. Now, to illustrate, the first one I call the victim adaptational style. And I analyzed family behaviors, not just individuals, okay? So I called it families of victims. These are the kind of families where people live like they're still victims. Everything, every little mishap becomes catastrophic. People cling to each other. Even when there is lots of love and humor, separations are extremely difficult. Every goodbye is a total threat, and you can understand why. Because in the Holocaust, very often, you didn't have the opportunity to say goodbye, but even if you did, it was forever.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting.
Separation and goodbyes become extremely threatening and scary to everyone. The same with overprotection. The parents would overprotect the children. The children, in response, would also overprotect the parents. So it became rather mutual, and people become extremely close for good and for bad. without being able to, for example, develop healthy privacy and independence, because it gets connected with a lot of guilt. The children wouldn't share their problems with the parents because they didn't want to burden them with them, you know.
Yeah.
I'm just throwing a whole bunch of behaviors at you that would make sense to many of our listeners.
Of course.
Expressing anger was dangerous for the same reason. Very often from this type of family, the children became mental health and mental health professionals. I always joke and say that children of this type of family, of the victim type, are trained professionals by the age of 3. They just need to wait for the licensing exam.
Really? Well, they're inundated with all of that. Wow.
They become so sensitive to others, to where the other person is, and they become so intent on it, and intent to help, and intent to repair. Repair becomes, it's extremely important. And remember the notion of repair, and remind me later, because that will jump to the current study. But I want to first, before I go to the study itself, the second type of families I call families of fighters. These kind of family, it's you work hard, you work all the time, you can't relax, you're not allowed to actually, you can't depend on anybody else. You must always be ready for any challenge. You must ready to get the world.
It sounds like me.
Like many people.
It sounds like
whole countries too.
Oh, I think I need to come to
see you. You're getting the picture, so to speak, right? You're always ready. Now, in the victim family, to give you an example, there's no trust of authorities, of course, because authorities betrayed you.
Yes.
And they end up sort of hiding from authorities. In comparison, the fighter families make it their business to stand up and to fight, you see?
Right.
So it's really a different way of life. It's a different way of being. It's a different way of viewing yourself and other people and different challenges. Like, it's harder for people in the fighter family, for example, delegate authority, right? But they must remain in charge all the time.
Right.
And while they look great from the outside, you know, these are sometimes they pay quite a price internally. They do look resilient, as do the victims, by the way, when it comes to resilience. But I want to caution the listeners,
yes,
not jump to conclusions about this is a better way of being, even though culturally it is, you know, it is an American way in many ways.
Yeah.
Because whatever we choose in life, whatever style of adaptation, we pay a price. So, if you can't delegate authority to others, not that you always overburden yourself, but you don't really come very close to other people. You don't really, really, really respect other people. And people around you might not like it. Including your, okay, so whatever we do, there's a price. The third type
of family?
Psychology, yes,
yes,
is what I call the NUMB family. That's N-U-M-B.
N-U-M-B?
N-U-M-B, numbing, N like Nancy, U,
yes.
M like Moses, B like boy.
Okay. Okay.
This is really the most tragic family. For the most part, the survivors in this family lost everyone. They're the sole survivors. Not only are they sole survivors, but they also lost their spouses and children. I've come to believe from my work, and not only with Holocaust, but with other genocides like Bosnia, Rwanda, places like South Africa, like Northern Ireland, that the loss of a child in front of you when you cannot do anything about it is absolutely, it's a wound that you cannot heal from. It's just an unhealable wound.
Could an example of this be the families that went to families, Sandy Hook with their children?
Families, the primary way of life in the Nam family is to not allow any feeling, no feeling. They seem to live as if the Holocaust is still here. It happened only half an hour ago. They're extremely protective of each other, the spouses, but don't necessarily attend to the children in any way that can be helpful in growing up in outside culture, because the children have to protect the parents more than anything else. As I said, no feeling is allowed, neither happy nor unhappy, because even happy feelings disturb the very precarious balance of adaptation here.
How common is this type of family that you're talking about, the Nam?
You ask excellent questions. Compared to the other two that I described, it's, bless God, it's the least common. But
if you had to say a percentage, is it like 10%?
What? Excuse me?
If you had to assign a percentage, 10%?
It would be in that range.
Okay.
The problem with, I'm not giving you an exact range. We will have some of it based on our study, but even our study is not sufficiently controlled to make a statement like that. But let me just, while I said, fortunately, it's a less frequent number. Unfortunately, these are the people who don't have a voice, right? They don't clamor for a voice because they are so worried all the they are so numb. And so these are the people who don't necessarily even come to treatment. And they become marginalized. It's very, very sad.
These people never leave their homes, or only leave their homes absolutely necessary.
They barely would leave their home. They would have businesses right in the house, like a small grocery store, and they would live upstairs, something like that. There was a film, I'm trying to remember the name of it, but I just don't offhand, that very much described the men like that. Maybe it will come to me, or maybe I will come back to you with the name of the film.
Okay, well.
And you can put it on your blog. Terms of, conveying that kind of,
family type.
Yes, or that kind of adaptation. So and we also see, people who've become among the fighters, the more extreme, the ones that I called those who made it in quotation marks, and those who devote their whole life either to commemorate or to succeed no matter what, or to, you know, to build awareness. And they pay, too, a high price for it. Now, for, I've written about this. It's published. If people want the reference, I'll gladly give it to them. And more recently, with the advent of the internet, and I was pleased, and I also published the International Handbook of Multigenerational Legacies of Trauma that describes 32 different populations around the world who underwent mass trauma of one kind or another. It's become the textbook in the field. But despite all these publications, et cetera, and the awareness has grown among clinicians, not enough has been done in systematically researching these mechanisms of adaptation. I kept saying to the young generation, please, you study it, and they said, there's no measure. So at any rate, so the most recent study I've been involved with some amazing co-researchers, is a study that is leading to developing a measure of multigenerational legacies of trauma. That is a measure of how trauma goes from generation to generation.
So that sounds very promising. Is that something that will be developed over a period of years that you're talking about?
We're working on it for about 2 years, and the last year most intensively. The beginning of it, this current study was with children of survivors of the Nazi Holocaust. We have had over 800 people responding. It's a questionnaire we built. It was in the internet, and also close to 200 of them we also interviewed in depth, and we do have very interesting results. Preliminary, so I don't like to. I don't want to jinx it. That's right. But I can say is that the typology of family adaptational style has mostly been confirmed. That is the family types, the victim, fighter, NAM families, has been confirmed.
Good to know that your research is being validated, you know, behaviorally and what you're seeing or people in your private practice. Can you tell us what has been of all the different venues that you're involved with, whether it's your research or with respect to being an author or a consultant or psychologist, what has been the most rewarding for you?
Oh my!
That's a good question, huh?
My clinical work is sacred to me.
Okay. Is that your legacy, your clinical work?
Well, my legacy with clinical work is to the people I work with, and hopefully the people around them. But my legacy also is in my writings, of course. And my research, and in effect, I hope very much to leave as a permanent legacy something I'm considering of building, which will be called something like an institute, a research center for multigenerational legacies of trauma. I would like the questionnaire to be applied to many populations around the world to see how they were affected by their victimizations, to learn a lot about that, and to follow several generations so we can literally make a, you know.
Well, you're making an impact, and it sounds like all of these things are like, are they all longitudinal studies? You're carrying them on from one generation to the next to the next?
That's correct. These are both longitudinal within the person's lifetime. That's the meaning of the adaptational style. And, of course, the multi-generational, absolutely, from generation to generation. And so that you can say that there is the clinical and then there is the theoretical and you know, and author and conceptual, and then there is the research. And let's not forget, part of what I've been involved with, independently of this but totally related, is in the amazing development in international law about victims' rights. I've been with amazing colleagues. I've worked on that from the first resolution, a declaration on behalf of on victims' rights to every single instrument that the international community created for and on behalf of victims, including the building of the, including the work towards reparations for victims of crimes and abuse of power and victims of all kinds of crime, and the building of the International Criminal Court, in particular the Trust Fund for Victims and the provisions for victims of the International Criminal Court.
And is this something that's been endorsed by the United Nations, what you're talking about?
That is correct. That is absolutely correct. These instruments are international law instruments.
Is that something that we can look up? If people are interested in knowing more about that as a specific topic, is there some place where they can look online to see, or maybe to compare what their state rights are? What is it like on an international scope? Is there a particular reference you would give us?
I would look victims' rights, international victims' rights.
Mm-hmm.
Trust Fund for Victims, International Criminal Court, remedy resolutions or international resolutions on reparations for victims.
Are they very different with respect to what we're used to in terms of the, you know, other nations? Is it a broad spectrum of ideas in terms of how victims' rights are carried out in other countries versus ours?
Actually, the United States has excellent provisions for victims. They can always be improved.
Yes.
Excellent. There is recognition of victims' rights, and the United States in many ways has been a leader in establishing internationally. Absolutely. We ought to feel very proud and profoundly proud, gratified with these contributions to the lot of the plight of victims around the world. And then the United States is still very involved in it, and hopefully it will remain so. But we're talking about, international rights, so that we extend the acknowledgement and the implementation of them across the world.
Right.
Now, one of the concepts that came out of this that would be of interest perhaps to lawyers who are listening to this show is what we call reparative justice.
Yeah. Can you define that for people?
Huh?
Can you define that for people?
Absolutely. Reparative justice is the process whereby victims' concerns and needs are redressed at every point in the process of justice. That is, even before the trial, when the victim is just being considered as a witness, for example, throughout every moment of in every interaction with the victim, throughout the trial, including the reparation provisions, and even following up after the trial to see the impact on the victim of not only the processes but the reparations and how they're doing. And I suggest that that is an extremely important focus for all those who interface with victims to be trained on.
Right. In fact, that's the focus of our show, the dealing with the aftermath of victimization and crime and whatnot, and trying to assess and help people, you know, not so much focusing on the actual crime itself or who is involved, but, you know, these other matters that really aren't addressed a lot of times, as you say. So we think it's very important. We have about 8 minutes left to our show. It's flying by here. We'll have to have you back sometime. But what is your sense of, in terms of the scope of the future and improving things, where do you feel like in our own generation, in our own lifetime, you and I and other people can make the most impact in terms of seeing the greatest improvement?
Oh, my. This is you're leaving that for the last minute. Okay.
No, we have 7 minutes.
Immediately, let's picture in our mind the different circles, okay? Many, many converging circles. One is within the family, and the other is in the community circle. The other is in the institutions of the community, including the religious institutions, educational institutions, cultural institutions, including the federal government, the state, including the city, the state, and then the international community, okay? And we can, if we really wanted to methodically answer your questions, we will list improvements in each one of them, okay?
Right.
The one improvement I'll say is to all of them would be to improve communication.
In all those realms.
It improves communication, whether it's in the family, whether it's with the family and the community. Teach your clergy what it's like to be a victim.
Mm-hmm.
They get trained, and that's fairly new. But what we know, tragically, is that the clergy participated in victimizing, right?
Mm-hmm.
They also covered things up. That is... created the conspiracy of silence in that way there, which made the victim suffer even more. And that's a big saga that we will continue to learn on and on and on and on. And it made people mistrust them, etc. And we can go on. You can have several shows just on that.
I'm sure.
Right, but even before we learned all of that, we knew that, for example, some of the clergy participated in blaming the victim, for example, when they were rape victims.
Yes.
Okay, so there's a great deal of training that's needed. There's excellent training that's needed to be given to clergy, to teachers, to every institution.
Mm-hmm. And should we do it, that as victims or people such as yours, who should be doing the training?
Well, experts in trauma and victims themselves who have been able to integrate the trauma into their lives.
Into their lives and be able to impart,
were able to transcend it and then can teach others. Now, let's not forget the media.
Yes.
It is crucial. The media, and I'm talking to you as such, and it's always a pleasure to me, you know, to compliment and to acknowledge the positive power the potential positive power of the media in,
yes,
in teaching communities and societies, but also in how the media themselves approach the victims, how they describe the victimization. Each one of those, when I talk about reparative justice, for example, I also think always about reparative media, reparative law enforcement, right? So to build a whole structure of reparative possibilities, reparative ways of helping to heal the victim rather than re-victimize the victim.
Right, and I would hope that we want this to be a reality versus the ideal.
Yes,
all of
absolutely.
These, right?
You couldn't say it better.
Well, thank you. I'm trying.
Yeah. I mean, we should be able to take it for granted. I totally agree with you. That would be marvelous.
That would mean we
adopted the impulse, the right impulse.
Mm-hmm. And, well, it sounds as if, you know, you divide your life into so many different sectors, and we just know that you are going to leave such a wonderful legacy, and it sounds like you'll be doing all of these things, you know, until, you know, the second before God calls you. I have that feeling about you, just like me. And, but with respect to any, you know, we've got maybe 2 minutes. What would you like to say for this go-around? Because we certainly could talk again in the future. What would be your parting words or parting advice to victims of trauma?
Each one of you is unique.
Okay.
Yeah, not like everybody. At the same time, you have reactions that other people have. And you shouldn't feel all alone and isolated and lonely about them. Even if people find it difficult to speak or to listen, take the risk. It's worth it. Don't make yourself alone. It's bad enough others do. Don't participate in that. Remember, that is within your control. You don't have to make yourself feel worse.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't do anybody any good. And it just keeps you miserable rather than living in kindness and soothing yourself. So you know that at least you take care of you, huh? It's really important to be able to do.
And that first step must be the hardest.
There are people in the world who care. The same world that created the victimization created many people who do care. Find them. There are many groups online. There are many self-help groups. There are many victim groups that can be of help at some point or another. There is the whole field of trauma that was created in order to understand and to be able to help effectively.
Yeah.
Seek the right kind of help. It is there.
Those are very powerful words, and that's a very positive note to leave us on. So I'm going to have to say, Thank you so much. I will be in touch with you off air, but we have to say good night for now. Please go to www.donnagore.com. Be sure to watch for our blog tomorrow and tune in next week for another episode. Thank you, Delilah. Thank you, Yale, for your wonderful talk this evening with us, and we'll be in touch soon. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening, dear. Take care.
Thank you. Okay, take care. Thank you, Delilah.